Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And it is October 1st, 2018. Doesn't seem like fall here in the eastern shore of Maryland. It's in the 80 degrees area in temperature wise. And how is it where you are at, Dave? Good afternoon.
Hey, happy Manic Monday. It's about the same here where I am as well. Fairly humid. Looked like it was 84 degrees at 3 o'clock Eastern time. And the Yellow Jackets are hanging out by my front door. So we're staying inside. I think one of my dogs may have been stung by one today. She's not a happy camper at the moment.
Interesting day. And of course, the Dow rose about 200 points today after the U.S. and Canada struck a deal to replace NAFTA. So I guess this all becomes and goes into effect December, I believe. But let's get do the market report first for gold and silver. And actually, I mean, gold was down all day to the tune of, it was as low as 1185, but it came back. It's still down $3, but we're looking at 1190. Silver was down 17 cents at $14.57. Platinum was up 8 at 827, but palladium was down almost 1 3, a little over 1 3/4%, down $19 at 1,068. The USDX today, of course, was stronger, 0.13 at 95.28, and crude oil was up 2.27. Huge day in crude oil, 75.52. And the paper markets today, let me find my way over to the paper markets. And again, the Dow was up most of the day, over 200 points. And it's close here in the last few numbers coming through, 195 to the upside on the Dow, 26,653. However, the NASDAQ was down 9 at 8,037, still above 8. And the S&P was up 10 points at 2,924. So, you know, yes, the Dow was up 200 points. But when you look at the number of shares in the Dow compared to the others, I don't think the trade agreement had that big of an impact on the markets. It's easy to manipulate 30 shares. A little more difficult with the NASDAQ and the S&P, and you know, they just did a normal day of trading. So in the Fear and Greed Index, we're looking still at 48, so it didn't rebound even with the announcement of the USMC.
UMSCA.
Oh, yeah. You know what it reminds me of is YMCA. Every time I hear somebody say that, I think of YMCA.
Well, apparently, yeah, we'll get to it in a second, but apparently the president wanted to keep it at, you know, UMSC in honor of the Marine Corps, and which, you know, would have more easily fit into the YMCA theme. He was talked out of the well-intentioned renaming to something more independently sounding.
So it is a USMCA.
It is.
It is. And yeah. But I still think of YMCA.
I know.
It's that CA thing at the end, I guess.
I think we're going to we should start a new trend and start calling it UMSCA.
UMSCA.
You know, everyone likes an acronym you can pronounce, right?
But so we did get the revision on the North American trade deal. And, you know, this has been going on for over a year, this agreement to update it. And the 1994 pact, it governs more than $1.2 trillion worth of trade among the three nations. And again, the deal doesn't go into effect right away. I also believe I was reading through some of the big takeaways from this, and I think it's like 5 years before some of it even goes into effect. But a lot of these are going to start 2020. Because you still have to have the three countries have to sign it and so forth. Then Congress and the legislatures in Canada and Mexico have to approve it. And, of course, that process is expected to take several months. And so, you know, we do have a little bit of an overview of the new agreement. And as we already mentioned, the biggest change, Dave, I think it's going to be for cars.
Yeah, it looks like... certainly the goal of this new deal is to have more cars and truck parts made in North America. I mean, starting in 2020, that's one of the delayed provisions, to qualify for zero tariffs, a car or truck is going to have at least 75% of its parts manufactured in Canada, Mexico, or the U.S., and that's a pretty substantial boost from the current 62.5% requirement. And then starting in 2020, also cars and trucks are going to have at least 30% of the work in the vehicle done by workers earning at least $16 an hour. Now, that's reportedly more than three times what the average Mexican car worker now makes. And that 30% figure goes up to a minimum of 40% for cars in 2023. Now, there's another big change for dairy. Canada is going to open up its milk market to U.S. farmers. That's huge. Under current practice, to ensure that Canadian dairy farmers don't go bankrupt, I mean, the Canadian government restricts how much dairy can be produced in the country and how much foreign dairy can enter to keep milk prices high. You know, in the end, Canada is keeping most of its own complex trade system in place, but it's giving a greater market share to U.S. dairy farmers. We'll see how that plays in Wisconsin and Michigan next month.
Well, that's about, from what I've seen, it's about 3.5%
of trade
that the U.S. dairy farmers will have access to.
Oh, well, that's not huge, is it?
No, it's about $16 billion annual domestic dairy market that they have. So
that's big.
Under the deal, also the Canadian government will be allowed to compensate dairy farmers hurt by the deal for their end. So, you know, they're going to have to pump up to some money. I don't know if there was anything else interested in there that I saw in there about the dairy products. And again, all this information is just coming out, and we can update you as we see changes and, you know, to these or more of access to what is actually going on in some of these. And, you know, it's funny, Canada had already agreed to open up wider access to dairy markets under the TPP. Under the proposed TPP that President Trump withdrew from back in January 2017. So it's just kind of interesting to see how it seems like there's changes, but yet a lot of this still remains the same. And but yeah, and that's great for our Wisconsin dairy farmers. And from the customer that we heard from, the client, the listener that we heard from, I hope his friend doesn't have to continue to throw away his milk. You know, so just destroy of his milk. So Chapter 19 of NAFTA had allowed for a special dispute process. That stays intact. Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau had repeatedly said that he wanted to keep Chapter 9 in place. And this Chapter 9 allows Canada, Mexico, and the United States to challenge one another's anti-dumping and countervailing duties in front of a panel of representatives from each country. So this is generally a little bit of easier process than trying to challenge a trade practice in the U.S. courts or even the WTO. Canada had successfully used Chapter 19 to challenge the U.S. on its softwood lumber restrictions. The steel tariffs are going to stay in place for now. Canada wanted the U.S. to stop the 25% tariffs on Canadian steel. That didn't happen yet. And the two countries are still talking about those lifting those tariffs, but a senior White House official had said yesterday that the process is on a completely separate track. So
Yeah, the UMSCA also makes a number of significant upgrades to environmental and labor regulations, especially regarding Mexico. For example, the new agreement stipulates that Mexican trucks that cross the border, I guess that means Mexico-made trucks that border cross the border into the U.S. must meet higher safety regulations than now, and that Mexican workers will have more ability to organize and form unions, presumably for better pay and benefits. Now, there's a new intellectual property chapter, which we know is a huge cornerstone of the discussions going on with, or the lack thereof, with China. But under UMSCA, 63 pages, contains more stringent protections for patents and trademarks, especially for biotech, financial services, and even web domain names. And in what I think is a big victory for Big Pharma, unfortunately, U.S. drug companies will be able to sell pharmaceuticals in Canada for 10 years before facing generic competition. That's up for from 8 years of the so-called market protection that are in place right now under NAFTA.
Well, you know, I mean, it's good for the farmers. It's good. I get all that. But you know what? It's also good for the financial services. It's good. You know, it's, you know, trickle down, ladies and gentlemen. You either believe in it or you don't. And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see just how much of this trickles down. But I don't know. I think it's, you know, again, it's great. I'd love to have it redone. I wish they would have just canceled it, period. But I guess you can't do that in today's world anymore. Chinese government bonds are looking to displace the dollar. We know that the rise of the USA unilateralism has given some new urgency to the perceived need for a world financial order that isn't dominated by America. China becomes the world's largest economy. When it does, it's going to will the financial world still be dominated by the dollar, the Treasury, and the Fed? And that's a question. And so China is doing everything possible to have a say in it. They've expressed after the Great Recession that they didn't believe that there should be a one reserve currency as the U.S. dollar. We've heard other countries come out and say the same thing. So even when the United States can credibly claim to have the best interests of the rest of the world at heart, you know, its allies chaff at China's overreach. And, you know, we told you on Friday that the EU, Russia, and China have agreed to create a separate payment system that would allow businesses in those countries to trade with Iran.
Yeah, it's really stepping up here, Melody. You know, already the Chinese yuan is the third largest of the five currencies that make up the SDR. The closest thing the world has to a global monetary yardstick. And come April of next year, Chinese government bonds, we're going to call them CGBs here, they'll similarly be the third largest component of one of the largest, most commonly used indexes, Bloomberg's Barclays Global Aggregate Bond Index. CGBs are, you know, increasingly proving to not only be attractive investments, but also important financial benchmarks that are being traded on rate desks alongside German bonds and U.S. treasuries. That's significant. And the Chinese bonds have performed very well this year so far. You know, while the Citigroup World Government Bond Index has fallen 1.4%, Chinese bonds have rallied lately, falling year to date by just 20 basis points, or 0.2%. They also have a lot of room to rally further, apparently, with its 10-year still trading at 3.7%. Now, that's extremely high for a reserve currency. You know, the equivalent numbers in the U.S., Germany, and Japan are 3%, roughly, 0.5% in Germany, 0.1% in Japan.
I think it was just last week that the 2-year treasury, our rate, was as high, pardon?
Three.
Was as high as it's been since 2008, and demand was very weak. The demand was very weak.
That doesn't spell good news for bond. Well, actually, you know, depending on your perspective. But go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
But yeah, but you know, I think that's interesting because it shows. I mean, demand is weak, and it's you know, those rates will have to rise.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get back to. But that's another topic, and we're going to continue on this one. So, you know, what is the bottom line on this with the Chinese government bond? And the ultimate goal, writes Andrew Capone in an excellent guide to the Chinese government bond market in the latest issue of Euromoney, is for CGBs to supplant the U.S. Treasuries as the global benchmark. So it's worth remembering that China has already managed a remarkable economic transition. The long-term planning that exists in China makes it a very different market from an investment perspective than the U.S. or the U.K. So there is no electoral cycle to worry about, and policy is directed toward execution and delivery. And above all, China has an enviable track record for macroeconomic stability. So even in 2008, growth remained above 6%, and it stayed there since then. Over the last decade, inflation has averaged about 2.3%. So inflation is the primary concern, Dave.
Well, according to one analyst, the People's Bank of China, their central bank, definitely want to keep inflation in check there. And more measures to control inflation other than the interest rate, including exchange rates. Now, an orthodox central bank is supported by a government that's conscious of its new role in the global financial and political system. The Federal Reserve has an inflation target, roughly 2%, personal core expenditures index, and will soon be fighting the fire caused by, you know, Congress's fiscal stimulus pouring fuel on, you know, our late cycle stock market boom. But when, you know, inflation did get out of control in the 70s, the results were disastrous for asset holders. For example, between 1967 and 77, the 20-year U.S. Treasury returned minus 1%, and equities fell 31.4%. There were few places to hide, Melody. So, you know, Xi Jinping, he goes to Davos, Switzerland, and talks to all the big buck guys and gals about free trade and the Paris Climate Agreement. He's trying to portray China as a responsible global system, one who's playing the long game.
But is that going to work? Or, you know, with the amount of debt that they have and so forth. But we're heading into a break right now, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back right after these few short messages.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website, dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter, and of course, you can listen to the programs archived on a long-term basis and live at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Just go to the little red bar on the website and click it, and there we will be. So, 800-375-4188. You know, ending out that segment, we were talking about China and what their true goal is and how they're trying to displace the United States, and that's really their main, that's what their main agenda is, Dave.
Yeah, it sure is. And, you know, whether it happens in 2025 or 2050, you know, they sure have a very focused goal on just that. And in my own mind, I don't think they necessarily have to get there as being, you know, the actual number one economic power. If not military power, I think it's just as important for other people in you know, across the world to perceive that they are. You know, these growing coalitions that they're trying to put together, the Chinese, Xi Jinping in particular, trying to put together, you know, are I think meant, you know, the first or the earlier steps on their way to world domination, whether it be, you know, perceived or actual, because as we know, in most cases, perception is reality, right?
So with the United States being the world economic power at this point in time, it makes it quite a challenge for them, right? Because eventually, well, I mean, it's like these countries are picking sides, basically. But bottom line is, when it comes down to the side that you're going to be on, I hate to say this, but you want to be on the winning the winning side. And when you have that economic growth behind you, you would think that, you know, you know where you're going to get the best deals, which would be the United States.
Well, that's how it is right now. It's what China's trying to undo. It's why we see them trying to extend influence in the Horn of Africa, in South America, you know, in even parts of the Middle East, and certainly the Far East. So, you know, the next 5-10 years internationally, you know, are going to be probably very telling for what you know, what, how the world is going to be aligned in 20 to 30 years from now.
I mean, look, they had the BRICS. I mean, that wasn't a very successful grouping.
Yeah, that's like, what? I mean, where did that go? I mean, that was, geez, just even what, 6 months ago, that was.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, so, you know, their ability to, you know, I guess it wasn't just the right mix, or maybe they're doing more behind the scenes, but they were creating banks, they were creating these systems, pretty much like what they're doing now, you know, with Russia and the European Union in order to continue the oil buying from Iran. So, you know, we're not really quite sure at this point in time how successful that's even going to be. And so it's, I guess they'll just keep trying until, It's really interesting, Dave, because you just don't know how it's really going to turn out, except the world is just consumed with debt. And one of these days, whether it's today, next month, next year, somewhere in this world, you're going to have that debt that's going to come home, and it's going to be that first domino that falls. And because every this whole world is with all these trade deals and everything else so intertwined, it can't help but just to, I mean, the contagion is there. It's real.
Yeah, I've begun to visualize the world debt in terms of an underground volcano, long extinct, and that you've got this, we'll call it a black hole for lack of a better word, where every country's debt is, you know, out of mind, out of sight for 99% of, you know, each country's citizenry. And so you've got this, I forget what the term is, but you got this black hole in the ocean, some ocean, that all of this debt is just being funneled down into. And it just so happens that there's a long dead volcano at the bottom of that part of the ocean. And as you say, at some point, the volcano is just going to get too full of pressure, and boom. Yeah. You know, not only does this volcano explode, but it rises to the surface, and it transforms the globe as we know it, and life as we know it. On a day-to-day basis, you put one step, ahead of the next. But if you really think long-term about it, it's like, wow, there are some really scary scenarios out there. And, we're not conspiracy theorists.
I am.
Well, you are, okay. But
I am.
I'll speak for myself there. I'm no conspiracy theorist, but, this, I don't like this new world order. I don't like the old one either. But if I had to choose, let's go for a different world order, a better world order.
Well, a U.S. How about a U.S. order? And we need to get our household in the United States together, and we need to cut the spending. But you get to the point when, and that's what people I don't think really understand, when you can't stop creating debt, you can't stop spending, not when you have as much debt as what we have. So you're going to see cuts here, cuts there. But if they came in and did any huge cuts in the entitlements or did huge cuts there, I mean, it would just unwind so fast you wouldn't believe it. And so they have to keep throwing money at it. And that's exactly what, and that's, I would think, viewing President Trump, even his history, you throw money to keep it going, and hopefully it sticks, and it bides you some time. And
that's all it does. It buys you time. But I would suggest that until the underlying political dysfunction is addressed, that is, there are substantial, significant governmental reforms, I'm just talking about the U.S. now, that our politics, aside from just how divisive and uncivil things tend to be today compared to another point in time, until they're fixed, I don't think any good intention is going to outweigh individual politics of individually elected representatives and senators. And look, at the core, that's what our future depends on, is for effective decision making. It's at least, you know, under our republic form of democracy. So, you know, how we get there, who knows? Do we have countrywide town halls? Ouch! Excuse me. Led by non-politician types. Who knows how we get to that? But you know, it seems like people on both sides of the aisle and political persuasions, I think, are starting to think more and more in terms of things like, you know, term limits, you know, independent citizen drawn legislative lines, getting huge anonymous money out of our elections.
And you know what? It's and as you're saying that, where we need changes, and yeah, we got that. God, the Congress is the most worthless group of. I mean, you know. Anyway, but you know, when we talk about draining the swamp, you know, draining the swamp isn't going to come from the head of the country. It's going to come from the people. And one thing that we have
been made clear.
I mean, one thing we have seen is we've seen the uprising of the people on both sides. And, you know, I mean, I'm not condoning, you know, anything, but this is what we're experiencing, is what we have to go through in order to begin to drain the swamp. You know, so yeah. I think this is a natural, you know, everybody's trying to figure out why, you know, the liberal left and, you know, hey, you know, and even, you know, some conservatives, you see the behavior, and then the people, the unrest, the you know, the anxiety that's being felt, the social unrest. And yes, it's fueled. It is fueled by many. And, you know, but perhaps that's just part of what we're going to have to go through in order to drain the swamp, was my point. So,
as Churchill once said, I know we don't like cursing on the show, but he once said, if you're going through hell, keep going. And while we're going through it, we just have to, you know, start making plans for, you know, how it's going to be. Yeah, when we get to the other side.
But, you know, we were talking about China. Today, China had canceled a security meeting with the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, and it was planned for this month. This was reported by a senior U.S. official yesterday, days after a top Chinese official said there was no reason to panic over tensions between the countries. I don't think there's any reason to panic either. You know, I don't think the tensions are nearly what they're going to be in the future, but, you know, we're just seeing little tensions right now. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, when things get hot and when things collapse and when the debt finally comes above and rises from that volcano. Fed Chair Martin Feldstein, he's warning that the Fed's will eventually be powerless to stop the nation's economy when the next recession hits. He says that the downturn brought on in the next few years by rising long-term interest rates would likely be deeper and longer than your average recession. And he says, and there's nothing at this point that the Federal Reserve or any other government actor can do to prevent that from happening. Feinstein warned, he says, that the P.E. ratio of the S&P regresses to its historical average, 40% below today's level, $10 trillion of household wealth would be wiped out. That puts a strong number on 40%. And everybody talks about that we're going to be at least 50%, 60%, maybe even 70%. So at 40%, it's $10 trillion of household wealth is going to be wiped out.
Phew.
Unless you have gold and silver.
There you go. That's, you know, the past relationship between household wealth and consumer spending suggests such a decline would reduce annual spending by about $400 billion, shrinking GDP by 2%. Feldstein added in the effects on business environment, and this spending crunch would push the economy into recession. Now, you know, most recessions are short, and most are shallow. relatively speaking, with an average of less than a year between the start of the downturn and the beginning of the recovery. That's because the Fed usually responds to recessions by cutting the Fed funds rate substantially. But if one hits in the next couple of years, you know, Feldstein, like a bunch of others, ourselves included, say the Fed won't have enough room to cut rates. You know, as the Fed funds rates expected to rise to, you know, only in the low 3% range by 2020. And good old Marty adds that there won't be much room for major fiscal interventions by Congress either. I mean, federal deficits are expected to exceed $1 trillion annually in the coming years, i.e. next year. We could get very close to it well, we'll see. I didn't see a final figure for the year just ended, fiscal year just ended. More importantly, publicly held federal debt's predicted to rise from 75% of GDP to actually over 100% by the end of the decade. So things are going to be a lot different this time around, come recession time.
Well, really, the Great Recession, it wasn't really, well, we're still not out of it. I mean, I get that. I mean, we never came out of it. But, I mean, the whole point is that the recession really did last from, 2008 to at least 2011. So, I mean, that was a pretty long recession.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, you can even stretch that to say it was longer than that. So, this one coming, it's going to be worse than that. So you're not going to have your the same type of response because this will just wipe out everyone. This will wipe out everyone. And, you know, Jerome Powell, you know, he comes out and he doesn't seem to be as pessimistic about the economic future. He said, you know, last Wednesday when he did the quarter point rate, he says he believes the U.S. economy doesn't face a large chance of recession in the next 2 years. What do you think he's going to tell you? Ladies and gentlemen, we better be careful because we're going to start that recession next month. Of course not. What else is he going to say? And then next year he'll probably say the same thing. Oh, we're not going to see one for another 2 years. And they're going to keep saying it until you look at your bank statements and it's been reduced, you know, by 50% or more. You know, then they'll come out and tell you, oh, gee, we're in a recession. it's just so annoying. But when asked whether the narrowing gap between the short-term and long-term interest rate points to the impending economic downturn, Powell said that the Fed's model suggests the economy is going to keep growing. Didn't they reduce the economy, the GDP, when he came out and said that?
Yeah,
Dave?
I'm not sure what you mean there, Melody, but
we're heading into a break. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two Black Berkey Elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. The only thing I want to bring up here quickly is I think it's interesting, is if I can find this report here. Iran, there's a report out of Istanbul claiming that Iran launched missile strikes today on what it said were Sunni Islamic extremists hideouts in eastern Syria. I saw the pictures, and it's a move being portrayed as a retaliation for a deadly terrorist attack on the Iranian military parade last month. The Iran's Revolutionary Guard said it fired six medium-range missiles into Syria from bases in western Iran at 2 a.m. local time, striking east of the Euphrates River and killing and wounding several militants. And it said its combat drones then targeted the sites. A statement on the guard's website described those kills as, all right, help me out, Dave.
I think it's Takfiri.
Takfiri?
Takfiri terrorist.
It's the first time I heard of those guys.
Yeah, it's just there's a translation for ISIS
or Al Qaeda it is referred to as the Islamic State, and so I found that kind of interesting, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, these strikes against the Islamic State today, you know, came even as Iran had blamed local Arab separatists for last month's attack in the southwestern city of Avaz. You know, that assault, as listeners will remember, at a military parade just a little over a week ago, saw a gunman kill at least two dozen people, including a four-year-old boy. Iran then identified the five perpetrators as residents of Avaz. But both the ISIS and a local separate group claimed responsibility for the attack. Iran accused regional rivals Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, no surprise there, of supporting the local Arab nationalists. And they've fought for autonomy from Iran's mainly ethnic Persian population. You know, Iran's show of strength today appeared to be more about sending a message to its adversaries, you know, than targeting those responsible for the assault. You know, at least four of the missiles landed in the Hajin area of eastern Syria, where the Islamic State is still alive or still active. You know, that's according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, based in the UK.
Well, you know, and I just want to finish up with this, since we're talking about Iran, and we can go back. The Trump administration opens a new chapter in American involvement in Syria, and President Trump is vowing to remain until the civil war's conclusion in a bid to halt Iran's expansion across the Middle East. This was articulated last week, this vision last week, by senior U.S. officials, and it's a dramatic reversal 6 months after President Trump said he would pull American troops out of Syria and end the U.S. involvement in a conflict that has killed at least a half a million people, and basically confounded two administrations. The State Department's Special Representative for Syria, James Jeffrey, said the United States would maintain a presence in the country, possibly including an extended military mission until Iran withdraws the soldiers and militia forces it commands. And we're in there until that and other conditions are met. And Jeffrey said late last week, clarifying that U.S. withdrawal was also linked to achieving lasting defeat of the Islamic State militants. So,
yeah, I mean, Jeffrey spoke a couple of days after Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, announced that we, the U.S., would not withdraw as long as Iranian troops are outside Iranian borders. And, you know, that new strategy raises the stakes for the administration in Syria, where it must navigate an array of obstacles that also include, not the least of which, is Russian support for Syrian President al-Assad, which we know has reduced his incentive to make concessions required to end the fighting. Now, you know, Iran, it seems, is unlikely to, you know, relinquish its foothold on the Mediterranean after, you know, decades-long investment that it dramatically expanded after the Syrian war began in 2011. You know, Iran's Revolutionary Guard is believed to command at least 10,000 fighters. That includes, you know, Shiite militiamen plus government soldiers. That's forming the backbone of a force that's helped Assad claw back vast areas of that country from rebels.
And, you know, the U.S. is keeping the U.N. Security Council as tactics negotiator with overseeing the creation of the new Syrian constitution and effort. The government has so far resisted. And so keeping with this new strategy, their officials have altered their depiction on how long the U.S. military force of about 2,000 troops stationed in Syria to combat the Islamic State's going to remain. So,
yeah, I mean, we appear to be linking the end of the ISIS mission to the goal of establishing security across all of Syria. You know, James Mattis, our defense secretary, told reporters last week that, you know, the military would remain in Syria until it could ensure that local forces there can prevent a militant resurgence like, you know, the one that occurred in Iraq after the U.S. Withdrew in 2011. You know, the Pentagon insists that the U.S. military mission in Syria has not changed. By law, it's really limited to combating the Islamic State.
So, another interesting part of the world. We'll see how that ends out. But, you know, in today's newsletter, and folks, you can go to our website, dgscoins.com, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. There's all kinds of great stuff in there. And Dave also has an article in there that'll be published in today's newsletter. We'll try to get it published early evening. And you wrote about where the ultra-rich invest, and of course where guys like us also invest, but first, mm-hmm. we're going to talk about the ultra-rich and see their take. Last week you wrote about two different directions that income and wealth have taken over the past couple of decades, depending on, you know, where you're located, whether you're in the 1-10% or the bottom of the 90% of households. And now this week's newsletter focuses on the ultra rich.
Yeah, I mean, a look at the ultra rich families around the world finds they aren't necessarily looking to maximize their investment returns. You know, most of them concentrate, you know, in whole or partly on preserving capital. That's preserving what they already have. You know, their main concern, never running out of money. You know, you think, how could a billionaire ever run out of money? Well, just wait. I mean, the 2018 UBS-sponsored Global Family Office Report looks at where, and that's an annual report, looks at where the 300 wealthiest family offices invest their money. Now, two of the top takeaways are this. I mean, these families are rich. As Melody characterized, they're the ultra-rich of the rich. Their average family net worth is $1.1 billion, while the average amount of assets managed by each family office is nearly $1 billion. It's $808 million. And these families care a lot about liquidity. So on average, they have 7% of their assets in cash. And that works out to more than $50 million per family on average. You know, and that allows them to fund the operations of their so-called family office, whether, you know, it's in the form of a foundation or a trust or some other nonprofit, and also enables them to you know, operate their whatever their missions are, be they, you know, charitable advances in science or medicine, whatever. But even with that large cash allocation, you know, the ultra rich's 2017 returns were pretty impressive. I mean, investments rose 15.5% overall, thanks mainly, of course, to performance from publicly sold equities. You know, that was more than double their 2016 performance of 7%. And significantly more from 2015 when their earnings were basically flat.
Well, you know, there's two things in there that I thought is important. Preserving capital. What better way to preserve your capital than with gold and silver?
Indeed.
And also liquidity. Yes, cash. But gold. Gold is the next second to liquidity. And so, you know, gold provides all of these things for you, ladies and gentlemen. And what I've also found interesting about this report was that a lot of this new money, 67% of these family offices were founded in 2000 or later.
Yeah.
Look at all what's gone on since 2000. By design? Absolutely.
new moolah.
Yeah.
Not blue-blooded moolah.
Nope.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. You know, in some ways, though, I guess you could say they're old-fashioned in terms of the male-female, who runs these family operations, these, you know, big-buck operations. You know, only 9% are women. That's not altogether surprising, although most of the 9% run businesses that were founded since 2000.
You know, it would really be interesting to see the breakout of the businesses since 2000.
Yeah, the report goes into that a little bit. What types of operations they're running? We know like their asset allocations. I found them surprising. I mean, overall, the families invest 44% of their wealth in stocks and bonds. You know, traditional, no real surprise there per se. There are a lot of private investments as well in both companies and properties. That might explain why, you know, the private equity giant Blackstone, for example, sees its assets under management reaching $1 trillion by 2026. That's astounding. 28% in public equities. That's up 5 percentage points from 2016. That's surprising too. What is particularly surprising is that their percentage allocation in precious metals is just 1%. Now on a dollar basis, you know, if you take $1.1 billion as the average level, that equates to, you know, a little over $10 million per family invested in gold and silver, probably primarily gold, actually, the report says. But as a percentage, I'm really surprised, particularly today. Now, you know, what we do know is that projections, and these are based on surveys from CFOs and CEOs of these family businesses. Those surveys did acknowledge that the family's investment in precious metals is going to go up 10% the rest of this year and next. So I believe that, to me, that signals, Melody, that these ultra rich are seeing what we've been seeing, that is a downturn in the paper market, stocks and bonds, and they're going to move over to safe haven. I'd say don't let the ultra rich lead by example in this case. We're not suggesting, you know, a specific allocation, because, you know, each person's situation and goals are different, but geez, 1%, woefully low. And these ultra rich, it seems to me, if they don't move more into gold, are gonna be hammered like crazy when the market does turn around.
You know, and it is. And again, you know, they're going to convert. And you're absolutely correct. You know, 1%, but these are the ultra wealthy. You know, they also have gold. They probably have gold collections and rare coins and things like that that we don't know about. They have artwork. You know, that it's... I think that was kind of interesting to see that they're going to be increasing their gold assets. They're it by 10%.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing I took out of the report. And sorry, you got to read to the end. It's not a very long article, but you got to go down toward the end of the article to catch some of those details.
You know, there was another leading economist this morning that said, we just haven't learned anything since the 2008 financial crash.
Nothing.
He says the Lawrence Ball, he's from the Johns Hopkins University, and he has a book out, The Fed and Lehman Brothers, Setting the Record Straight on a Financial Disaster, spelled out his fears for today's economy. He says some economists believe that the improvements made since 2008 should prevent a similar crisis. But Ball stressed that what he felt was the necessity of robust rules in the banking industry. Another crisis similar or worse than what we saw 10 years ago. And I see we're out of time. So we'll be back. I'll be here with Pastor Butch tomorrow. So until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Dave. You're welcome.
That's too bad.